facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, marvelous Maverick Monday to you. It's the Cale Clark Show. So glad you're with me today. And I can't wait to hear from you. Your phone calls are a very, very important part of this program. Give me a shout, 1-888-914-9149. It's the toll-free studio line, 1-888-914-9149. You can also tweet at me, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And there's also the show account, which you're going to want to follow too, at Cale Clark Show. The email address, cale@relevantradio.com. And today, of course, October the 19th, is the feast of St. Jean de Brébeuf, St. Isaac Jogues and their companions, the Jesuit martyr saints of North America. It's funny because living in Toronto, very, very close to the Martyr Shrine, which is a couple hours away from where I live in Midland, Ontario, these guys are known as the Canadian martyrs up here, but they're also known as the North American martyrs because most of them died, were martyred for the faith. Yeah, somewhere around, you know, Ontario, the province of Canada where I live, and also New York State. And St. Isaac Jogues died in what's now New York State. It was all kind of mashed together at that time. And these were the first martyrs for the faith in North America. And most people don't know too much about them, but they are really, really compelling and so inspiring when we look at their lives and what they're willing to give up for the gospel of Christ, which was really everything. And, you know, because it's Maverick Monday, you know, we talk about Maverick and Goose and all the other characters from Top Gun. You know, these guys are really the elite, the best of the best. And they were willing to serve at Top Gun. Of course, this is not real. But the Jesuit martyrs of North America, these guys really were the elite and the best of the best in their own societies. They had so much going for themselves, intellectually, professionally, personally. The fact that they were willing to go to a land that they knew was going to be incredibly tough weather-wise. It was going to be incredibly punishing physically. They knew there's a very, very good chance that they would never, ever come home. And they embraced that. They embraced that wholeheartedly. I want to tell you a little bit about St. Jean de Brébeuf. And he was born in Normandy, France. And his family was kind of what you might say, the lesser nobility. Of course, there were nobles in France. They weren't quite up there, but they would kind of work the land, the family of Jean de Brébeuf. And when he was a boy, Jean would have herded sheep. He would have fed the cows, that sort of thing, kind of like a Midwestern person in the United States, perhaps. And when he was old enough, he would have taken on some of the more heavier chores as well, plowing the fields and all of that stuff. And he studied at the University of Cayenne, where he probably met the Jesuits at that point. And he actually became a Jesuit novitiate in Rouen in 1621. And for a while, when he was getting involved with the Jesuits, he taught boys at the local Jesuit school. And of course, Jesuits were really big on education. But that wasn't God's plan for him to teach for the rest of his life. And so in the New World, at one point, the Franciscans were really the ones doing missionary work there with the native peoples of North America. But they were asking for help, and they asked the Jesuits to send some people for help. And that's exactly what happened here. In 1624, they asked the French religious orders, including the Jesuits, to send assistance. And among the first people to volunteer to go over was Jean de Brébeuf. And at this point, he was 32 years old, a very tall guy, a very a robust guy, very physically well-built, and he needed to be for all the stuff he was going to have to endure, believe me. And so what he was really, really good at, he was incredibly good with languages. And as one writer said, the great explorer, actually, of North America, Samuel de Champlain, he wrote about Brébeuf. He said he had such a great gift for learning languages that he would figure out in about 2 or 3 years what other people, it would take them more than 20 years to learn. So he would need that as he was trying to share the gospel with the native peoples of North America. And so he tried to do everything he possibly could to fit in with that culture. He would eat their food. He would try to learn their language. And he would, you know, basically operate according to their customs. And one of the things that they would do is something called portaging. Now, if you're an outdoor enthusiast, you might have heard of this before, but that involves going in these birch bark canoes And it was a very, very rugged journey because you'd go on this stream or a lake with a canoe, but then eventually you'd have to pick it up and carry it along with all your gear through the woods, up rocky terrain perhaps, and go into another lake. And you would kind of do this all day long until you got to where you were going. And this is what the native peoples of the Huron peoples are really the ones that were more receptive to the gospel. And Jean de Brébeuf and his Jesuit companions tried really hard to share the gospel with these guys. And some of them were not very trusting of the Christian missionaries because they thought they were kind of sorcerers and, you know, they weren't quite sure what they were trying to do. But they were more receptive than the mortal enemies of the Hurons, the Iroquois. And the Iroquois did not want to have anything to do with this. They were incredibly not only against the Jesuits, but they were also against the Hurons too, and they would fight quite often. So on a typical day's journey that Jean de Brébeuf would undertake with his Huron friends, they would usually paddle for about 30 miles a day. And they would just sit in these birch bark canoes and they would barely even move except for swinging their arms to paddle their small canoes. They would rise at dawn every day. They would just heat up some water and kind of a campsite motif and throw in some cornmeal into that water. And that was kind of their morning meal. And then they would just row and row and row until the evening came along. And then they would make camp for the night, eat more cornmeal, and sleep on the ground. And mosquitoes were all over the place, very, very heavily wooded areas, you can imagine. Deer flies, other insects, didn't matter. They would just kind of sleep on the ground and put up with it. And then at dawn, the whole thing would start all over again. And Jean de Brébeuf would keep up with these guys, and he would, you know, participate in their life and what, you know, how they were operating. And they gave him a nickname, which was called Ekon, which really means in the Huron language, the one who carries the load, the one who carries the load. And he certainly did carry his load for sure. He wrote documents in their language. He wrote a very famous Christmas carol called the Huron Carol in their native language. You might have heard this translated into English. And he really grew to love the Huron people. And he noted that they had a lot of virtue that it was rare among peoples that he had ever met in his life. They were so hospitable to strangers, no matter where they came from, that when they would have a feast, they would give you the very best food that they had to prepare. And they would just really open their hearts. So he went back to, St. Jean de Brébeuf went back to France for a little while in 1629. But then he came back to the New World in 1635. And this is around the time when things got very, very dangerous for the Jesuits. A smallpox epidemic broke out among them, and unfortunately it spread to the Huron population, and they didn't have any immunity at all from this disease. And so many of them died, but the Christian missionaries would care for them. The Jesuits would baptize, in fact, thousands of Hurons as they lay dying from the smallpox epidemic. But a lot of the Hurons were kind of freaked out by this because they were baptizing people before they died. And so they thought that baptism was actually making them die. And so they started to turn against the Jesuits, who they called the Black Robes. And so Jean de Brébeuf and his companions decided they needed to kind of get out of Dodge for a little while and retreat to an area where it was a little bit safer. So they went to a place called Saint Marie among the Hurons, which is very, very close to what's now the Martyrs' Shrine in Midland, Ontario. However, some false rumors were about, and one of the false rumors circulated that Jean de Brébeuf was actually in cahoots with the Seneca clan of the Iroquois. And of course, they were the sworn enemies of the Huron tribes. So he moved again. He moved to another site of St. Louis. But the Iroquois attacked that village on March the 16th in 1639. And they took a lot of the Hurons who had converted to Catholicism, along with Jean de Brébeuf and another Jesuit layman by the name of Gabriel Lalemant, prisoner. And this is when his martyrdom happened. Now, if you're a little bit squeamish, you might not want to listen for the next 20 or 30 seconds because I'm going to tell you exactly what they did to him. And this torture was among the cruelest that anyone has ever had to endure in martyrdom for Christ. basically what happened was the Iroquois heated up these metal hatchets, hatchet blades, if you will, until they were absolutely glowing red hot. And then they tied them together and made a necklace of sorts out of them. And they put that necklace over the neck, shoulder area of Jean de Brebeuf. And of course, that just seared into his flesh. They then wrapped up his torso with bark, tree bark, and set it on fire. They cut off his nose. They cut off his lips. They took a hot iron and they forced it down his throat. They poured boiling water over his head. And of course, that was to mock the sacrament of baptism. They were well known for baptizing many of the indigenous peoples there. And so they decided to baptize him and Gabriel Lallemant in boiling water. They scalped him. They flayed his flesh from his bones while he was still alive. And then finally someone buried a hatchet in his jaw and killed him. After he died, he had exhibited such incredible fortitude. He never once cried out during the entire ordeal, which greatly amazed the Iroquois. And these were fierce warriors, and they were so impressed with his bravery in the face of torture and death that after he died, they cut his heart out of his chest and they ate it. Now, I'm not trying to be gory here, but the reason why they did that was because they wanted some of his courage. Whatever enabled him to do this, they wanted it. And that's what they did. And so he died, Jean de Brebeuf and his companion, Gabriel Lallemant, a Jesuit layman. They died on March the 16th, 1639. He was 55 years old at the time. And so on September the 26th, it's their feast day in Canada, but today, October the 19th, is their feast in the United States, where they're known as the North American Martyrs. And let me tell you about Isaac Jogues as well, because his story is also quite compelling. And he was born in Orleans, France, on January the 10th, 1607, so very, very early 17th century. And his family was quite wealthy. And when he was 17, I mean, he had the whole world at his feet, Isaac Jogues. He had finished university, and he was a champion athlete. He was a great swimmer. He was incredibly intelligent, could have been anything he wanted to be. But he decided to enter the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus. It's really incredible how Ignatius of Loyola, the movement that he started, was able to attract the best and brightest of the young men at that time. And of course, this was during the Counter-Reformation period of history. And of course, on October the 31st, it's Halloween, but it's also Reformation Day in the Protestant world, because that's the day that Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany. And that's really what touched off the Protestant Revolution. And the Jesuits arose as kind of, in part, as a response to this, seeking to spread the faith, spread the Catholic faith around the world, especially to new places where it had never been before. And as the Protestant Revolution was spreading across Europe, many interesting things were happening on the other side of the globe. Of course, this is around the time when Our Lady of Guadalupe appeared in Mexico and touched off 8 million conversions to the Catholic faith. It's obviously in the 17th century as well is when the Jesuits brought the faith, the Catholic faith, to North America. So Isaac Jogues wanted to sign up for this for sure. And when he was asked why he wanted to enter the Jesuits, his response was this. He said, Ethiopia and martyrdom. Ethiopia and martyrdom. He thought he was going to be sent to Ethiopia, and he wanted to be a martyr. He was looking for it. You know, I don't recommend that necessarily, but because many people in church history who wanted to become martyrs flaked out when they were under fire and they wound up renouncing the faith. But God gives grace, you know, to those who don't necessarily think they can pull it off. And anyways, Isaac Jogues had a lot of confidence in God and what God wanted him to do. Well, the priest who was kind of looking, you know, over his case answered him this way. He said, not so, my son. Not so, my son. You were actually going to die in Canada. In Canada. So he spent 12 years in formation, and Isaac Jogues was ordained at the age of 29, and he became a missionary in the New World. He was actually the first European to stand on the shores of Lake Superior, one of the Great Lakes, of course. And it was really a wilderness environment. He was the first priest, the first Catholic priest to ever set foot in what is now New York State. And life in the New World was very, very difficult. The Jesuit mission that he signed up to join in the New World was in really bad shape. Sanitation was awful. The food was disgusting. Vermin were all over the place. It was filthy. And then, of course, there were the issues with the native peoples that they were trying to minister to. You know, as I said before, sometimes the Hurons, who were the most receptive to the gospel, they were still a little bit suspicious of the Jesuits, and sometimes a lot of them wanted to kill them. But of course, the Iroquois were the number one threat. And Isaac Jogues once wrote in a letter back home, he said, "The Iroquois swore that if they ever took another Frenchman captive, they would burn him alive over a slow fire, in the same way that they inflict the direst tortures on their other prisoners." Well, his initial capture happened on August the 1st, 1642. He was traveling with some fellow Jesuits and some of the Hurons to get some supplies, and during their journey, they were attacked by a band of 70 Mohawk warriors that were members of the Iroquois tribe. They grabbed a hold of Father Isaac Jogues, they beat him with their fists, they beat him with clubs, they beat him with sticks until he lay unconscious. And when he woke up in captivity, they, and again, if you're squeamish, you might want to, you know, plug your ears for a few minutes and just say, no, you're not going to want to hear this. They actually not only chewed off of his fingernails, but they actually bit off the two forefingers on each hand, the index fingers, because they were aware that he used his fingers in his religious rituals, of course, to handle the sacred host in celebrating the Mass. So they bit off his finger up to the first knuckle on each of his index fingers. So he spent 17 months in captivity, and he actually became the slave of the Iroquois chief of that tribe. He was treated worse than an animal would be. But even under those circumstances, he found a way to share his faith, and somehow he was able to baptize 70 people during this time. Most of them were Native North Americans who lay dying. And at that point, they were very, very open to what he had to say, and he was able to baptize them before they died. He would care for the sick, and he actually wound up taking care of one of the guys who bit off his finger. He was able to look after him as he was ill. Well, eventually he was able to escape. He escaped, got out of the situation, and he actually went into Manhattan. Of course, there was a big settlement in Manhattan, and there were a lot of Protestants there in Manhattan at that time too, Dutch Protestants. And no priest had ever been in Manhattan before he got there either. So, you know, he went to New York, I guess you could say. And a young man saw Isaac Jogues, and he ran up to him. He knelt at his feet, and he took the mangled hands of the priest and put them next to his lips, and he said, "Martyr of Jesus Christ, martyr of Jesus Christ." And Isaac Jogues was very surprised, and he asked him, "Are you Catholic?" And the guy said, "No, I'm a Lutheran, but I recognize you as one who has suffered for the Master." So eventually he went back home to France, and he was there in time for Christmas that year. And he actually was able to go to Mass. He got special permission from the Pope to celebrate Mass, even though it was difficult for him with all of his injuries, of course. But he was very, very delighted to be back home and to be able to celebrate the Eucharist with his friends. And he traveled for 200 miles to get to the nearest Jesuit college so he could be with some of his Jesuit brothers. And when he got there, he knocked on the door, and the guy who answered it said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm coming with news from the missions in North America." And the guy got really excited. He was like, "You got to be kidding me. Do you know Father Isaac Jogues?" And he said, "Yeah, actually, I know him very well. I know him really well." And the guy replied, "Is he dead? Have they murdered him?" And Isaac Jogues said, "Nope, he's alive and well. And in fact, he's the guy speaking to you right now." So he was welcomed in with open arms and told a lot of stories about what was going on overseas. He became a national hero. Even the Queen of France wanted to talk to him And when she met him, she said, "People write romances for us, but was there ever such a romance as this? A real life, you know, inspiring tale that could be a novel, you know, in this day it would be a movie." But believe it or not, even though he was safe at home in France, nothing did he want more than to return to the new world, even though he knew that if he were to go again, he wouldn't be coming back. And so 4 months, only 4 months after his return, he set back off to the new world. And his superiors really didn't want him to do this, but they allowed it. And he once again went on an expedition with the Hurons to try to talk peace with the Iroquois, with the Mohawks. But unfortunately, on their way, the Mohawks captured him. And this time they made sure that he would never escape. He died from being tomahawked in the head. And his last words were, "I do not fear death or torture. I do not know why you would kill me. I only come to give peace and to show you the way to heaven." So inspiring stories about the martyrdoms of St. Jean de Brébeuf, whose skull actually resides at the Martyr Shrine here in Ontario, about 2 hours from where I live in Toronto. And of course, St. Isaac Jogues, who died in what is now New York State. And hopefully they'll give us some courage as we consider, you know, what keeps us from telling others about our faith in Christ. We're going to take a quick break on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, but we'll be back right after this. Give us a call, 1-888-914-9149.
The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Yep, God calls us to be heroes too. We're called to be saints just as much as Jean de Brébeuf and St. Isaac Jogues, the saints who we celebrate today, and their companions, the North American martyrs. And you know what? One way that we can really be heroes is to make sure that we get out and vote. No matter what you choose to do, it's an important civic responsibility. And as a Catholic, you've got to form your conscience well to be able to do that in accord with the principles of our church. And that's why Father Rocky, the CEO of Relevant Radio, has written a brand new ebook called Vote Your Conscience. And you can get it for free by simply going to relevantradio.com/vote. That's relevantradio.com/vote. And in this book, in this wonderful ebook, in Vote Your Conscience, Father Rocky will give you valuable information about how church teachings can help us to form our conscience so that when we go to the polls, we can implement really the truth, the beauty, the goodness of our faith, and make good moral choices, not only at the polls, but in everything that we do, in raising our family, evangelizing those around us. It's a great book. I've read it. It's wonderful. So just go to relevantradio.com/vote, or you can also sign up on the Relevant Radio app. All right. Now, we talked before the break about the martyr saints of North America and what they were willing to go through, all the savage tortures that they endured as they sought to share the gospel with others. And they knew they were going to die. They knew they were going to suffer. And yet they did it anyways. They could have easily opted for the comforts of home, especially in the case of St. Isaac Jogues, who was really celebrated as a hero. He could have, you know, written books and, you know, just lived a life of ease, you know, telling stories about his adventures in the new world. But he decided to go back and once again endure the hardships and face certain death. So there was an interesting contrast that I came across to this attitude that they had. The very famous Barna Research Group just did a poll about why millennials don't want to share their faith. And it's really fascinating. It kind of breaks down attitudes about sharing the faith among different population groups. Of course, there are the boomers, well, even before the boomers, there are the elders, and the elders are people who were born before the year 1946, so they'd be like 73 years of age and older. The boomers, of course, were born between 46 to 64. Gen X, that's where I fit in, 1965 to 1983. And the millennials, of course, were born from the year 1984 to 1998. So these guys would be young adults right now. The millennials would be about age 20 to 34 years old. And it's really interesting because all of these different groups, you know, the elders, the boomers, the Gen Xers, the millennials, all of them think that it's really, really important to share their faith. And across the board, there's like 96%, 97% agreement as to, you know, that fact, that part of being a person of faith means to share it with others. And it's also interesting that everybody also agrees, it's well into the 90s in agreement, that the best thing that could ever happen to somebody else is for them to come to know Jesus. So, and by the way, when we try to share our faith with people, we're not sort of instrumentalizing the friendship. You know, we're not using the friendship, if you will, as a means. You know, we're only being friends with this person so we can evangelize them. That's not what it is at all. We're just taking friendship to its natural and logical end and conclusion, because if you're a friend, you really want to share the best of what you have with your friends. You know, we tell them about our favorite movies, our favorite TV shows, our favorite restaurants, whatever. We're so eager to share these things. Well, we want to share the most important thing in our life, which is our faith. And that's why we do what we do. That's why we should share our faith. But it's interesting when it comes to the millennials, because there is no other group that's better equipped to share their faith than the millennials. In fact, almost 75% of the millennials, the young adults in this survey, they said that they know exactly how to respond whenever somebody has a question about faith, whenever they get a skeptic that they encounter online or in person, or somebody asks a question about the faith, they know how to respond. And that actually makes sense, because they're the Google generation, right? Like, they're children of the digital age, and they know exactly where to find the answers to these questions, right? I mean, they're very comfortable with being online, and they know where to look. So they feel really equipped to share their faith. But here's the thing. Even though they have the answers, they don't want to share them. They don't want to share them with others. This is a staggering statistic. About 47% of the millennials think that it's wrong to share your personal beliefs with someone of a different faith in the hopes that they will one day become part of your group, share the same faith as you. And that is not true when it comes to older generations. You know, Gen Xers, boomers, elders, about 80% of those think that, yeah, no, you should want to share your faith. But millennials don't want to do that. About half of them don't want to do that. And I think that's really fascinating. And I think it's because they feel that, and here's some other questions that were in the poll. If someone disagrees with you, it means that they're judging you. They were very strong on this question. Millennials were, you know, almost half of them said that, yeah, if somebody disagrees with you, it means they're judging you. And I think they've got a bit of confusion here. And this is very, very common in this day and age, to say that to reject somebody's argument is to reject the person. And we are so sensitive to these things these days that if you reject me, or if you reject something that I believe, or if you reject my lifestyle or something that I think is true, then that means you're rejecting me as a person. And I think that's one of the reasons why millennials don't want to share their faith with others, because they don't want to feel like they're rejecting their friends. And so that's a big thing that happens. But here's another thing too. A lot of these millennials are very likely to lose their own faith as well. And that, I think that goes hand in hand with not wanting to share their faith. Because if you share your faith, you're going to come up against questions. You're going to come up against opposition. And that's going to help you in a lot of ways. Because you're going to know what questions people are actually asking out there. If you try to share your faith, you're going to find that out really quick. Because people will ask questions. And so that helps you to grow, because you've got to find the answers too, right? You've got to look up the answers. If someone asks a question, you don't know the answer, say, that's a great question. It doesn't mean your faith isn't true. It just means I've got to go back and do some digging here and find the answer. So you'll grow, And you'll actually grow stronger in your faith because you will have had to, you know, they always say, like, you'll retain 90% of information that you have to teach to someone else. If you're just passively, you know, taking in information like a couch potato watching television, you'll retain a little bit of it. But when you actually have to teach it to someone else, that's when you really have to grow in it yourself. And that's when it really takes root in you. I think about Mormon missionaries, you know, like I certainly don't believe that Mormonism is true. I think there's a lot of good reason to believe it's not true. One day we'll have to do a show on Mormonism and what Mormons really believe. But one thing that is true in Mormonism is that they tend to have a lot of staying power, in that just about every Mormon male, when they're, you know, early 20s, late teens, goes on a 2-year mission trip somewhere in the world. Sometimes they stay local in North America. Sometimes they go overseas. But if you have to undergo some sort of suffering and really like give of your life, give of your time and undergo hardship for your faith, you're more likely to stay in it, whether it's actually true or not. And that's one thing that's happened to them. Now, truth really does matter. That's the ultimate question. You know, is your faith true? That's the number one thing. I only point that out to say that sharing your faith does help you to keep it. And in high school, college age years, people dropping out of the Catholic faith, it's become a huge problem among younger people in North America. So, and it also is really discouraging for other people too, because if you see your friends like not going to mass anymore, if you see your friends not going to church and not wanting to share their faith with anybody else, then that's not exactly going to excite you either. So that has a sort of evangelistic effect too, when people don't practice their faith. So we've really got to focus on ways that we can ground young people in the truths of the Catholic faith. And I think that means better religious education, better catechism, a formation in the faith, apologetics. And how do you do that? Great questions. Maybe you have some insights. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Give us a call, 1-888-914-9149. So, hey, maybe if they could have met Isaac Jogues in the flesh as a young 29-year-old guy, best of the brightest, going to give his life in North America and all the hardship he was going to endure. Maybe, you know, every millennial needs to meet somebody like that. So there's lots of interesting things that we can learn from the North American martyrs about how to undergo suffering, how to love those who don't necessarily love you back, and how to deal with hardship in life. You know, they really had to rough it. They really had to rough it. That is for sure. And, changing gears ever so slightly, actually maybe a lot here on the Cale Clark Show, it seems that a lot of you out there are willing to embrace a more nomadic lifestyle. Maybe you could be a traveling missionary. What am I talking about? Well, Fox News is reporting that the majority of Americans would actually consider living out of a van in order to save money and pay off their debts. And I think a lot of this obviously has to do with the COVID-19 pandemic, obviously, that we're living through. 52% of Americans apparently would be open to doing this. And the hashtag van life, I don't know if you've seen this, it's been all over social media. There's actually a Facebook group with a hashtag van life title that has over 30,000 members. It's also all over the place on Twitter, Instagram, you name it, it is everywhere. And this would be the idea of living full-time or maybe part-time in an RV, you know, in a camper van that, you know, that would have modern amenities, of course, because you can't go without Wi-Fi. And a lot of these camper vans do have Wi-Fi. They have bed, stoves, full kitchens, you know, bathrooms, everything like that. But 52% of Americans would consider doing this on a full-time or a part-time basis. You know, maybe motivational speaker Matt Foley was really on to something back in the day.
Young lady, what do you want to do with your life?
I want to live in a van down by the river.
Well, you'll have plenty of time to live in a van down by the river when you're living in a van down by the river.
All right, of course, that was the late, great Chris Farley, with his incredible character, Matt Foley, the motivational speaker. Back when Saturday Night Live was actually funny, way back when, reaching way back for that one. But that was a great skit. Living in a van down by the river. Well, apparently a lot of you want to do this. So I don't know. And there's a moving company called Move.org that surveyed hundreds of people about this. And really, again, a lot of this is due to, money. That's a motivating factor. 72% said they would do this because they wanted to pay off debts. And some of them just wanted to travel. Some of them wanted to just, like, you know, be free and be able to, you know, live, you know, park your van near a beach, live closer to nature. I can kind of identify with that. You know, I've had this strange feeling for the last several years that, you know, I'm just determined that God is calling me to a beach ministry. I don't know. I just can't shake this feeling. But anyways, travel is another thing. Obviously, nobody's really traveling internationally, that's for sure. So getting in an RV and traveling around would be kind of interesting. So I don't know. Could you live in a van? Give me a call. 1-888-914-9149. It's funny, every year I go on a retreat for a few days, and I live in a very, very small room, and I get all my stuff, and I don't take too much stuff because the room is really small, and I've got to make sure it all fits. And that's when you realize, you know, you really don't need that much stuff. You know, we all accumulate a lot of stuff in life, and you know, sometimes we feel like we need to call Maria Kondo or someone to help us declutter. But you really don't need that much stuff, and it's kind of freeing to realize that. And I know when you have family and stuff, it's tough to not accumulate things. But I had a professor that he gave away every single thing that he owned twice in his life. He did that twice. He gave away everything and started fresh. I wish I had that kind of discipline, but seems like a lot of you guys want to do that too. I don't know. Maybe we can go cruising around together in an RV and listen to Relevant Radio as we do that. It's a great way to do it. Give me a call. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. Going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
I live in a van down by the river.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the program. So glad that you're here with me, and I'm happy to be here with you. There's nowhere else I'd rather be right now than talking to you on Relevant Radio. Although, even though there is one other place I kind of want to be right now, is right in front of my TV watching my Buffalo Bills play the defending Super Bowl champions, the Kansas City Chiefs. And I'm recording the game. I don't know what the score is. I don't want to know what it is. So don't tweet at me. Don't call me and tell me what the score is. I want to save it for later. And I'll act like, I'm just kind of staying away from media till I can watch the game later. And there are an awful lot of commercials in a football game, if you haven't noticed. So it's also good to watch it on tape delay, because you can kind of cycle through all that and get some of your life back. We're going to go to the phones right now. Anna is calling in Miami. How are you, Anna? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being a great addition to Relevant Radio. I wanted to bring up the two things about evangelizing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is obviously through catechesis. But the catechesis, I used to run a program. And the catechesis that really I found worked the best was when you included the whole family.
Hmm.
So not only, you know, having the individual grades catechesis, but at the same time inviting the parents to stay. And then there would be an adult or two leading with the readings of Sunday. But it became almost like a community. And people actually became good friends. And it reminded me of the church again of the 60s and 70s, where the church was a community of supporters of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Where someone got sick, all the mothers would make sure that family would have food for a week. And it just really brought out, I think, a wonderful thing throughout that community. And the children enjoyed it because the parents were also involved, more time with the parents.
Oh, that's very interesting. Now, thank you for that, Anna. I think that you're onto something there for sure. And where I live, actually, there's a big movement of family catechisms as well that are happening, kind of like really rising up from the grassroots level and taking root in some parishes in the area. And I really see the benefits of this for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. And I really like what you said, you know, getting back to the church of the 60s and 70s. But I want to get back even further, even way further back. I want to go back to the 60s and 70s of the first century, because it's really a lot like the original church, the early Christians. And that's kind of what we should shoot for in a certain sense, right? Like trying to recapture their missionary spirit and their zeal. And I do think that the faith back then spread mostly through word of mouth, through personal friendships and trust, because, of course, the faith was illegal back then in the Roman Empire. You couldn't have like public events, even public masses. And I think these family catechisms kind of harken back to that time for a lot of the reasons that you said. And my understanding also is that, not having participated in it myself, is that everybody is responsible to kind of teach as well. And remember when I said that you retain 90% of that which you teach? Older kids teach classes for younger kids. Parents have to take turns teaching some of the sessions to other parents. And I think the involvement of the parents, as you mentioned, Anna, is so crucial, because that's what's missing in a lot of ministries to young people in the church. Very often, if they do manage to reach the young people, it doesn't go very far in the end if the parents also don't get involved. If the parents aren't going to church, if the parents don't get evangelized and catechized, things tend to not stick sometimes, because it is hard for kids to take it seriously if their parents aren't. And sometimes they do anyway. Sometimes they come to believe themselves, and that's great. But really, you know, parents are, you know, the church says that parents are the primary educators of their children in the faith. And we've fallen down a lot in that area over the last few decades. And I do think that these family catechisms can really help in that regard. So thank you for that call, Anna, and for your kind words. Really appreciate you listening down in sunny Miami. And we're going to go back to the phones right now. We're going to go to Gabriel in Homestead, Florida. Gabriel, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, and you? I was hoping for us to have a civilized conversation until I heard about you being a Buffalo Bills fan. And here I am being a Dolphins fan, so I'm not sure how that's possible.
Well, hey, they're having a good year this year. You know, things are looking up. They play tough.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But I really enjoy your show.
Oh, thank you, sir. I really appreciate that. Really appreciate that. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think, you know, when you talk about millennials, I deal with children on a weekly basis. I'm a mental mm-hmm. health therapist, and I think that a lot of the issues that certain kids or millennials or even, you know, again, younger kids are dealing with today is they're taught by their parents not to talk about politics, not to talk about religion, and not just because you're afraid that you might lose a friend, but you don't want to mm-hmm. offend people. People walk on glass these days, and I think it reminds me of, since you brought up SNL there, it reminds me of a movie back then called PCU. It's called Politically Correct University, and how things would turn today when we're just worried about offending people. I mean, I mm-hmm. think people get scared of talking about religion, because if you're telling somebody that you believe in something to your core, to your soul, then you're kind of implying what they believe in is incorrect. You know,
yeah.
And I think that's where people kind of take offense to certain conversations like that.
Yeah, Gabriel, I think you're really onto something there, and I really do appreciate that call and your very kind words as well. Really glad that you're listening down in Homestead, Florida. And I think that's true. Like, I mean, obviously, that's a great example to bring up the political climate, because, I mean, people are getting, you know, physically assaulted, you know, obviously at rallies these days, just because people don't agree with who they might vote for. And clearly, we've got to be better than this. But there is a lot of, you know, passion that can be ignited, obviously, because of these things. And G.K. Chesterton, that great convert to the faith, the British convert, had so many great, you know, one-liners. You know, one of the things he said was that the two things that we're not supposed to talk about at parties, right, politics and religion, those are the two most important subjects, right? Because religion has to do with love of God, and politics really is about love of neighbor, right? It's like how to form a good society, the best society that we can. And so these are the things that people don't want to talk about, but they're the two most important subjects. And I do think that, you know, people do shy away because of the kind of reactions that they might get. So that's why I really do think one of the best ways we can share the faith is, again, in this context of friendship, of really, you know, wanting to give our best to our friends. And if our friends know that we truly love them and respect them, we can form a bridge through which we can, you know, the bridge has to be pretty strong, a bridge of friendship, before you drive a truckload of truth, you know, over that bridge. And that is something that we've really got to work on. But generally speaking, if the friendship is strong, it can handle some of these disagreements, because the person knows that they're accepted as a friend no matter what, even if they choose to reject when we share the gospel. That friendship should, you know, we don't drop our friends if they don't agree with what we're telling them. We hope that they come around. We hope that they come to see things our way. But we certainly don't reject them. In fact, that's when they need us even more. And another thing that you said, I think was very, very important. When you do really believe in something, for example, the Catholic faith, you're implying that these other belief systems are wrong. And that is true. That is really true. That's why for a lot of people, conversion is a messy process. It's not just looking at the facts and saying, oh, obviously these things happen in history, so obviously I should become a Catholic. People are more complicated because a lot of them are involved in sinful lifestyles and they don't want to change. That colors the way they look at the evidence, where they think, oh, maybe I can, in the back of their mind, they're thinking, maybe I can do it later. Maybe I can get serious about the faith later. I've got some sinning to do now, right? St. Augustine was like that. He was a very, very bright individual, obviously. And he said, Lord, make me pure, but not yet. You know, he did not want to change his ways, but eventually God got a hold of him and he did. And so really, when you're telling someone that the way that they look at the world is wrong, the glasses through which they see the world are not the right pair, you know, they got to put on the Catholic glasses because they're the original pair. You know, it's almost like a death for that person, because, you know, that means that everything that they've built their life on, you know, was faulty at some level. And so that's a really painful thing for people to go through. And we've got to be cognizant of that as we try to share the faith with our friends, that, you know, it will take time. In most cases, it does take some time. These, you know, fast conversions are pretty rare. And some of them don't last very long either, because they're just based on, you know, they get fired up with enthusiasm, but there's no root, you know, like that parable of the soils that Jesus told so often. All right, we're going to go to Julie in St. Paul, Minnesota. Julie, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I'm just commenting on your hashtag living in a van commentary you made.
Yeah.
And my concern, the first thing that comes to mind with that is I'm a big fan of living simply and decluttering, and I'm a world traveler and love traveling, but the number one thing that comes to mind with that is mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's conducive to raising a family and having mm-hmm. children. And so that it just makes me think that the folks out there, the Americans out there, are not really child-minded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point, Julie, and I got to jump in here. Thank you so much for calling and listening in St. Paul, Minnesota. We're almost out of time, but I do think that is true. I do think there is a tendency among a lot of younger couples to kind of delay not only marriage, but delay having a family and bringing up children because of career issues, things they want to do in life. And in some ways, they're missing out. And it will actually strengthen their marriage a lot if they do have children. Studies have shown that marital satisfaction, marriages stay together when there's children involved. There's no question about that. Timory's up next. She'll talk much more about marriage and family life, as she always does. And really want to thank you for joining me on the K.O. Clark Show. Don't forget the Faith Explained program, 12:30 Central. Talking about the Book of Revelation. That's our sister program. Don't miss it. Thank you to Lucas, our producer. Thank you for everyone who made this program happen. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.